I actually, since I'm also giving a kind of a public lecture this evening on the very broad theme of math and physics, I actually took occasion to, in this colloquium, kind of to survey quite broadly interactions between modern mathematics and modern physics, particularly in the realm of quantum field theory, string theory, just to give you kind of a general overview. And of course, I mean, it's a grand topic because math and physics have been together for a long time, sometimes less and more successful, and I'm very much aware I'm giving this lecture at an Institute for Theoretical Physics. And so, of course, within physics, there's a specific attitude towards mathematics. And in fact, I noticed that all the jokes about mathematicians and physicists, they're usually at the cost of the mathematician. So it would be very dangerous to tell one, if only this was one that I learned from a mathematician, namely from Alan Kohn, Fields Medalist, etc. And so the way he kind of characterized the difference between a mathematician and a physicist was that you have the physicist, you see him here on the bottom, you know, which has a big bag of dirty laundry, and he wants to do his laundry. So he goes into the village, and he's looking for a laundrette. And certainly, he sees a little shop. Of course, it's the shop run by the mathematician. And it says laundrette, it says, but it also says cafe, it says restaurant, it says hotel, all of it. And then the physicist comes and says, oh, can I please do my dirty laundry here? And the mathematician said, no, unfortunately not. No, but what, you know, you have this sign. Yeah, the only thing that we sell here are advertising signs. And there's a lot of grand words often used in mathematics, but I actually want to kind of give a better indication of kind of what I would feel is one of the most consistently exciting, intellectually challenging subjects the last, say, 30, 40 years. And now this goes back, of course, a long time. Beginning of modern physics, famous words of Galileo, I was like that he said, you know, nature was this book written in the language of mathematics, which at that time was Euclidean mathematics, Euclidean geometry, so characters are triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures. And I think many people say this is still true. In fact, my most wonderful quote about this is Feynman, who was actually not, of course, known as a great lover of mathematics, but he had this great sentence that if you really, for those of you who do not know mathematics, difficult to get across the real feeling to the beauty, the deepest beauty of nature. And you have to learn the language that she spoke in. But Feynman, of course, also had this wonderful quote, if all mathematics disappeared today, physics would be set back exactly 1 week. And also, this was like the definite word. And then as a famous mathematician gave me a good answer, he said, well, actually, this was the week God created the world. So I would say 2-to-1 mathematics to physics, probably. But actually, I think also in thinking of these interactions, there are kind of various points of view. And there's a split. Very much as you have in the theoretical physics community about what we usually would say kind of field theory or elementary particle theory, condensed matter. And it's really about where do you feel the deepest beauty of nature is hidden. And there are two points of view, of course. There's the reductionist point of view that great beauty and elegance and mathematical structures are to be found at the very bottom, at the smallest structures. So at the very beginning, we would say, of the Riemannization group, where the fundamental theories are to be found. A handful of particles describing the rest of the world. And of course, there's another point of view, which is just the opposite, saying, which is more the condensed matter point of view, where you say, no, the beauty is really in the emergent structures, the structures we see at a large scale, the structures that we find at the end of the Riemannization group, where actually beautiful mathematics appears. And in some sense, you can argue that these two points of view are a little bit about geometry and algebra. But I would say geometry takes the point of view of the large scale structures, and algebra is much more involved with the quantum structures at a very short distance. And so what you see actually is that there's this tension in some sense and connection between the two fields, which makes, I think, these interactions between math and physics so interesting. For instance, we see many examples where we take a geometrical object, for instance, a knot or some of the geometry of a manifold, a space-time manifold, a structure, geometrical structure, and then interpret this as an object within a quantum system. Which means, actually, that the rules of quantum mechanics, which you can endlessly vary and enrich, will, in some sense, associate a number, for instance, a complex number as the probability amplitude, but could be a much richer algebraic structure, associate this to the particular object. So, for instance, to a knot, you can associate a complex number or something much more fancy. Of course, once you're on the right-hand side in terms of algebra, then you can have various operations. You can kind of do difference relations, or recursion relations, all kind of the full toolbox of algebra you can use. And but then there is also, and I think this is particularly fascinating, so there you would say that you start with the classical structure, which is geometry, and then quantize it and come into the realm of algebra. But actually, I think it's very exciting. We also see developments the other way around, where the starting point is algebra, or even more basic, number theory or topology, very, very, very abstract structures that are, in some sense, the fundamental quantum system. And then in some limits, geometry appears, which is, would be an effect of geometry. And so I think the fact that we have these two angles, these two ways, and in some sense brings a very natural synthesis, which of course is, from a theoretical physics point of view, very exciting, that there's kind of a uniform mathematical structure describing all of this. Could be called quantum geometry. I mean, string theory is certainly an approach, has been my approach to this, but I think there's a much more general sense that various mathematical areas can come together. And I think that's one of the great things of being a physicist and work in areas where mathematicians have some stake, is that you are, in some sense, totally uncultured, and you very easily go and transverse various areas of mathematics that are not supposed to kind of mix, and that makes it actually kind of fun. Now, I would say, actually, if you think of it, and I will try to do this a little bit kind of systematic way, if you think of the various kind of levels, using kind of almost a computer game analogy of physics, you can see, actually, the very kind of physics bringing around a certain kind of mathematics. So I would say kind of classical mechanics is really how do you go from A to B, you know, straight path or geodesic. And of course, this is very old, back to the 17th century, you developed calculus, geometry, and it's still very rich, dynamical systems, chaos, etc. So this is I would say, a level a lot of mathematics is still at. Then we get to quantum mechanics, which from this point of view would be described as really the kind of sum of history, so all possible paths to take. And by itself, this is already, I think, a very fundamental change in thinking about mathematical structures. Now, we know what comes along with this. This is typically developed in the early 20th century, functional analysis, operator algebra, differential topology, K-theory. But I think, actually, it's much deeper. Because the natural kind of quantum mechanical point of view in thinking of ensembles of structures where you can naturally average over has been quite fundamental in thinking of lots of mathematical problems, where instead of looking at an individual case, you look at the total collection of objects. So the third level, I would say, is quantum field theory, where you start in A, but you could end up in B and C. So we think of the creation and annihilation of particles. And this is actually a really relatively recent field. I would say quantum field theory, really its impact in mathematics only started in the 1980s in terms of knot theory, three manifolds, four manifolds. I think now it's quite blooming. There's a huge area of kind of mathematically applied quantum field theory. And I would say kind of string theory, particularly perturbative string theory, is a very natural element of that thinking. It's thinking not in terms of world lines, but in terms of Riemann surfaces. And so the study of conformal field theory, algebraic curves, many of these things will appear in the colloquium, brought a tremendous interest in this, and I think large areas of algebraic geometry into it, where actually, and that's another phenomenon, mathematicians have felt free to push this subject in directions physicists wouldn't typically be doing or interested in, like, for instance, doing this not over the complex numbers of other fields, which is, it has been very, very powerful. And then I said, you know, this general issue, how do you think about quantum gravity where geometry themselves are just kind of becoming uncertain? And I think here these new ideas of emergent geometry are very interesting. But there's a whole area, I would say, a developing area in various branches of mathematics that we can feel are connected to this. So it's clearly very exciting. Now, the way I structure a talk, I want to kind of introduce various principles that are come together. And I would identify three. So one certainly is the idea of general relativity, thinking about geometries, curved space, topology of space and time. Then there is the algebraic point of view, thinking about quantum systems, gauge theories, non-commutative structures. Clearly, in gravity, we're thinking much more in a commutative point of view. And then finally, I would say kind of in general strings, brains, or extended objects, which have a marvelous way of connecting the first two. I think that is certainly something which has proven extremely useful, that string theory has been able to connect, in some sense, these two worlds of geometry and algebra. And there are various things to be said. You know, I think there's quite a large consensus of what the ingredients should be. So there should be some kind of non-commutativity in quantum gravity. It should be some kind of deformation of classical geometry. So we always want to think of taking certain limits. In some way, we expect that in quantum geometry, there is some kind of discretized structure, very much like we quantize orbits in phase space. Holography is very important, so geometry emerging, possibly out of systems of lesser space-time dimensions. Also, I think the question, which has been quite influential in string theory, that in some sense the questions you ask in geometry depends on the probe by which you kind of explore the system. So there could be a geometrical structure, could be many, many different things, depending on which observations you make. And certainly, I think, room for new variables. In mathematics and all of this is, I think, has various aspects. One thing I think is that people definitely think that, you know, we have to get new fields of mathematics be involved. And that has been proven successful time and time again. Another very deep structure is in this whole thing, which is much more like a program than a very specific topic. It's very similar to some of the large programs in mathematics, like the Langlands program, which have, you know, some concrete cases, an interesting set of conjectures, various kind of pieces. But it's almost like understanding a manifold through different coordinate charts. I think it's fair to say that in this whole program of quantum geometry, we haven't yet a unified point of view. And so the big question is, will we continue finding interesting examples, tying things together, finding deep symmetries, or at some point, will there be a more unified point of view of all this? And of course, always the issue of whether mathematics is not shifting or attracting the ship of physics in the wrong direction, and we're just attracted by this lovely mathematics, but it's irrelevant. And I think one of the things often we go with our intuition here and saying that certain mathematical structures are beautiful. But here I also notice there are kind of two concepts of beauty often, even within the mathematical culture itself. There's certainly a group of mathematicians who really like universal structures, who say there's nothing more beautiful than a vector space or something. On the other hand, there's people who like exceptional structures. Basically, we're looking for this very unique, exceptional mathematical structure that ideally exists only one of, like E8 or the monster group or something like that. And both are beautiful, but often from one perspective, the other is just a kind of boring exception to a general rule, while we might actually say that the general rules are boring. So even there, I think there is various ways in which we can go. And of course, there's also a question, what is the added value of a mathematical precise understanding? And now, certainly in quantum field theory, we know there are very deep problems at constructing quantum field theory from the very bottom up. We also have discovered extremely rich structure in, I would say, ordinary perturbative quantum field theory, Feynman diagrams, etc. The recent formulations that you have heard a lot about here, twister reformulation, MHV calculus, etc. And the various kind of dualities that relate all these things together. So I say, you know, in some sense, from my approach, we'll see how kind of simple examples in string theory are tying these various topics together. So to give one, which is actually still, in some sense, my favorite example, how string theory, for instance, can explain between quotation marks or give an intuition for deep structures in mathematics, I will take my favorite example, which is the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, one of the deepest results in mathematics. That tells something about the index, or the number of zero modes of the Dirac operator, and expresses it in a topological invariant of the manifold. So it connects analysis, analyzing a particular kind of partial differential operator, and connecting it to the topology of the manifold. And there's a very beautiful kind of graphical proof of this using string theory. So what you use here, and I'll have this particular diagram, which is an open string, or at least it's this kind of cylinder connecting two planes, and two planes are two D-branes. And there are kind of two limits of the diagram you can take. You can take one limit where the two branes are very close to each other. Time is now going around along the circle. So we think of this as basically a particle going around, a very short open string. The thing then will actually will compute in a natural way the trace and will actually produce the index of the Dirac operator. And then there's the other limit where the branes are far apart and actually the cylinder gets deformed in another way, in which it basically looks again one-dimensional, but now it's like a line connecting the two branes. And actually, in this case, it'll be a graviton connecting the two. And so this is more looking like an inner product between these two branes. And actually, that gives in a natural way the right-hand side of the equation. So that's typical, I think, of the kind of structures that we build. You build kind of an intermediate structure out of, in this case, string theory, take two limits, and then actually find that you are connecting two areas which are not supposed to connect. I think the Atiyah-Singer index theorem is a famous example of a mathematical result, and all the predecessors of that, that we're tying two fields, topology and analysis, that a priori we're not really supposed to have a close connection. So the way I actually structure the talk is actually think of it in some sense as a two-step process where we have two deformation parameters. So the first parameter from string theory perspective will be the step going from point particles to strings. So we have a thing called the string length, L string over here. And then there is a second parameter, which is, you can think of the Planck's constant on the world sheet of the string. And then the second parameter is the string coupling constant, which you can think of the Planck's constant in space-time. Of course, it's controlling the joining and splitting of strings. Now, And so one way, of course, the string coupling constant comes in because it very naturally, if you start to think of the sum over histories, the sum of string topologies, it will control the perturbative expansion of the string theory partition function in terms of Riemann surfaces. Now, if you think of these two parameters, you can basically make a little phase diagram, whether they're small or large. So here you would have, you know, point particles would be, you have L string very small, N would be kind of, the coupling constant would be very small. If you tune up the string coupling, then actually they become, instead of point particles, become one-dimensional extended objects. If you just tune on the coupling, we get quantum field theory. And if you tune up both, we get kind of this quantum gravity brain-like structures, which are in some sense the upper hand border. Now, that also means that if you're thinking of generalizations of actual geometry, we typically think of two ways. The one way is to think of stringy geometry, which is thinking really of looking at a space-time, a classical space-time, through the eyes of a string, so through string measurements. And then there is the more Planckian point of view, where both the string coupling and the string length are both non-zero, or large, where you expect, in some sense, fluctuating geometries. Now, if you build this up like this, it actually fits very well. You could actually identify large areas of standard geometry and topology, starting with point particles. So for instance, if you do supersymmetric quantum mechanics, the Hilbert space will be the space of differential forms. The Hamiltonian will be the Laplacian. And if you look at ground states, you find the harmonic forms. So you can, a mathematician can kind of understand and reconstruct all of classical geometry and topology just using the language of quantum mechanics. And a famous example is, for instance, the Witten index of a quantum mechanical system, which will compute the Euler number of the manifold. Now, if we tune on the string length, actually means that we will not study the space itself, but we study the loop space. Now, the loop space of a manifold is a much more interesting subject, particularly because I think from a mathematical perspective, there are various ways to look at loop spaces. But from a physical perspective, you always want to think of the loop space as kind of a thickened version of the original space. So we want to think of our strings always as small perturbations of an infinitesimal one, so basically a point-like object, which means that you get a very precise way to quantize the loop space in terms of Fock spaces And clearly, here we get into the realm of infinite dimensional analysis, I think, which is well under control. This is a subject, a classical subject, that by now well understood. It ties together with beautiful kind of algebraic structures. And one of the exciting things from that project, studying these kind of loop spaces, is that you get a much more interesting space of these structures. I mean, in some sense, you get a modelized space of conformal field theories, which is much more interesting elements than just the space of geometrical structures. So for instance, you could have various kind of limits which are kind of large volume limits. So for instance, you have this big space, you have at certain kind of ends. On one end, you would find a certain classical structure X. And on the other end, you would find a completely different classical structure, X prime. So for instance, for one thing that these structures do is tying together two different kinds of geometries that would a priori have no relation if not there is this kind of intermediate structure in between. You could have singularities, of course, you know, at really very special points where extra symmetries appear. And then there are, in fact, conformal field theories which have no large volume limit. So there are structures which are basically have no classical form, are just existing there as kind of islands, things like sporadic conformal field theories. And then there are various deep symmetries, like T-dualities, that could relate various ends. And so you would have symmetries relating manifolds, which have geometrical structures that, for a classical mathematical point of view, have no relation. We also see that in the classification of conformal field theories, there is essentially two points of view, which I think actually, again, are algebra and geometry as the two tools to analyze this. So the first is to really think in terms of structures of algebra. So in this kind of famous pair of Pan's diagram, which tells you that you have two states basically joining into a third state. That means that there's a whole structure of infinite dimensional vertex algebras hidden in that description of conformal field theory. So one thing that you could do is take an exclusively algebraic point of view, analyze this in the greatest details, ideally with additional structure, and try to get some algebraic classification of systems. Another point of view is just take the theory and put it on as many different geometries as you can think of. So study these theories on arbitrary Riemann surfaces and then use the fact that they are should be general covariant. Now, this happened in two dimensions, but I think there's actually quite a general approach these days to quantum field theory. I would say there are, at this point, two main points of attack on understanding quantum field theory. One is the algebraic one, thinking in terms of scattering data, thinking in terms of operator products, which is really probing the local physics in terms of, for instance, OPEs, et cetera. And the second thing is kind of putting your quantum field theory on various kind of geometries, so higher topology, compute indices, or put geometrical defects in it in order to probe the theory further. Now, the second one has been extremely successful, of course, in string theory. And once we include brains, which you can think of in the fixed time picture as endpoints of open strings, and which would kind of coexist then with closed strings, or in a space-time picture, you can think of kind of a relative version of conformal field theory, a place where Riemann surfaces can appear with certain boundary conditions. That has been extremely fruitful, in particular because brains bring into the structure the kind of non-commutative structure. So the amazing thing is in brains, if you have a set of brains coinciding with a certain multiplicity, so I think this was, again, a kind of way of thinking that was new in mathematics. It's quite obvious to think of terms of a submanifold or something more ugly, but anyhow, some geometrical structure. But then the interesting thing is that in the physics, we say, well, what happens if you put n of them on top of each other? And the string theory picture was, well, clearly, if you have open strings connecting them, now you can kind of pull them apart, and we get this kind of matrix of strings, because they are colored by, so to say, their beginning and end points. So you very naturally get matrix structures associated to it. So you get non-commutativity, kind of guaranteed. And in fact, you know, if you just think of the joining and opening of these strings, you have very natural cat matrix multiplication. So brains and defects, in a very natural way, lead to kind of non-commutative algebraic structures. And the kind of dualities that we are studying, where we have basically strong weak coupling dualities, we will have situations where, on the one hand, we have to relate structures which have to do with perturbative string theory. So it will to do with conformal field theories on Riemann surfaces of various kinds of topologies. So you really are studying very deep mathematical structures hidden, for instance, in the modelized space of Riemann surfaces. And on the other hand, you will have the structure of matrices or more general vector bundles, non-abelian gauge fields, connections on bundles or on sheaves, and so the whole language of non-commutative geometry. And again, this is something that these two areas were not supposed to connect. And I think that's, again, I will give you a few examples. That's a very, very kind of deep structure. And so what we've kind of learned from that, that at the, if you have classical geometry and then stringy geometry, the kind of more, the full version of string vacua and quantum field theory, we have, again, a beautiful structure in terms of the modelized spaces of the things that we are studying. I mean, another element of all of this is often, from a physical point of view, we have a better understanding of the family of objects, so the modelized space, than the object itself. Many quantum field theories, we don't have a proper definition. But we, in some sense, have a very good notion of what the modelized space of the structure should be. And that, in fact, that's kind of tantalizing, that you can see the family, so to say. You can see the parameter space of the object, but you can't see the object itself. And here, too, we'll have structures where you could have, you know, string vacua or quantum geometries on various ends. There could be various weak coupling limits in this grand family of theories. And again, you can have singularities. You can have isolated objects. And looking back, in some sense, what we learned in the 1980s, 1990s, in terms of understanding two-dimensional conformal field theory, I think we now see this really in a much grander way in terms of space-time theories, in particular, I think, in terms of quantum geometries. Now, all of this is the various kind of toy models which kind of explain this better. And I think that's a general problem with this big program, that we don't have a unified point of view. We work and kind of case by case and try to absorb some longer, more important lessons. So I think I want now to mention a few examples out of the realm of so-called topological string theory, which is in some sense a toy model for the full string. It's really a little bit thinking in terms of topology in terms versus geometry. It's interesting because these are toy models which are really nice to find mathematical applications. But at the same time, they also capture some of the exactly computable elements of much grander theories. A special role is played by dimension 6 or complex dimension 3, or where we have Calabi-Yau manifolds. So these are complex three-dimensional solutions of Einstein's equations. As I said, it's a way to more directly connect to all kind of exciting mathematics. So typically what we're looking at are quantum amplitudes where we map Riemann surfaces into the Calabi-Yau with the special condition that these maps, when we think of the two-dimensional string world space as being described by a single complex parameter, where these maps are holomorphic or pseudo-holomorphic in a technical sense. So we have holomorphic maps. So it's a little bit more like complexifying quantum mechanics by thinking of the world line now as a complex line than really taking fully use of the two-dimensional structures. So the great thing that in this context, you can do many exact computations of path integrals. For instance, the typical thing that you will compute is the amplitude of a string moving in that space. And it will be some kind of a generating function where you count the various curves of various degrees. So you count them with the counting parameter E, this exponential counting parameter. And the coefficients will be some suitably defined numbers, quote unquote, that are computing the number of maps. Sometimes these maps come in families, so you have to do some subtle mathematics to extract the number. The number, therefore, is not necessarily always an integer. It could be some rational number. But it has a good, a proper mathematical definition. Now, the way to see that this is kind of generalizing geometry is that if you go back to this fundamental structure, which is this kind of pair of Penn's diagram, in the classical case, so the case where we have basically quantum mechanics as its limit, that structure is very simple. The physical fields are just the cohomology classes on the manifold, so just the closed differential forms. And the product, this pair of pants product, the gluing of the strings together, is actually just the wedge product. So this is the fundamental algebraic structure a topologist would assign to manifolds. It's just the cohomology groups together with their natural wedge product. Now, one way to think about this is if you think, I always like this picture, if you think of cohomology classes in a manifold as being dual to certain cycles, then this three-point function is computing the triple intersection of these cycles. So literally, if you have three manifolds of the right dimension, they will intersect in a number of points, like I pictured here with three two planes intersecting in a point in three dimensions. And the number of these points will then be computed using this triple wedge product. Now, if you start to include string corrections, that is to say you include not intersections which are a point, but intersections which are a two-dimensional surface, for instance, a two-dimensional sphere in the case of rational curves, you have more a picture like this. Now, there are still three planes. They now, you say that they intersect if there is an intermediate curve. This is the string world surface. That's kind of connecting, that intersects in each of the three cycles. And if this curve then has degree d, so it's wrapping around d times around an internal cycle, it will come with this particular kind of instanton contribution. And so this is kind of a deformation of the natural product there is on the cohomology of a manifold. And that's a beautiful structure called quantum cohomology. For instance, if you have a projective space, the quantum cohomology is very simple. It's just a single generator and it has this structure that if you raise it to the power n plus 1 at 0, in the quantum cohomology, this relation gets deformed. So it's also a deformation of an algebraic structure where it's no longer nilpotent, but now it has this beautiful structure here. And certainly, I think the space has much more symmetries. For instance, in this very simple case, if you take P1 or a two-sphere, you can compute a quantum cohomology and see actually that if you add the string corrections, you can kind of get a moduli space of two spheres, which is kind of beautiful because you can continue it into kind of negative area. So there's a thing, technical thing called a flop, where you take a local two-sphere and you basically turn it inside out. But the string theory is totally smooth. So if I would say the two-dimensional conformal field theory or sigma model is totally smooth. So you typically see that singularities in these moduli spaces get smoothed out. Now this is, say, at level 2. If you go to level 3 and include all the string corrections, we have to compute much more complicated objects. So we have to compute objects like this, a sum over all genera, so all possible topologies. For instance, if we do a vacuum diagram of the invariants coming out of these Riemann surfaces. Now, I think that I would still feel is a kind of a miracle, that structures like this make sense in a mathematical world and actually give rise to beautiful mathematics, because it looks really contrived and complicated. And my favorite example is actually this one, which is actually almost thinking about empty space. So in the case of topological strings, that space has to be have three complex dimensions. So we just think of the space C3. And I visualized it here in terms of what's technically called its toric diagram. So what you do is you only plot the absolute values of the three complex numbers. So this is something that you should think of either as the corner of a room or the edge of a cube. Now, you're looking actually either in or on top of a cube. So that's the positive octant of R3. And so since this is such a simple space, it's very simple also to do string theory in it. And in fact, if you have to look maps of Riemann surfaces into this space, but they have to be holomorphic. And a holomorphic map into just an affine space is naturally constant. So basically what happens is the whole string is just mapped to a point. The only point is the only structure that's left is you can have, of course, arbitrary kind of geometrical structure on that world sheet. So there's still a whole moduli space of complex structures on the world sheet. And so you have to do some very complicated integral over the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. So amazing thing is that this thing can be defined and computed. So here's the technical answer. So you have to integrate this cohomology class, and you get this Bernoulli number. So it's also not an integer. It's a rational number. actually with quite a large denominator. And then you have to sum them all up, and you have to hope that something nice happens. And this is actually a beautiful calculation. If you sum up these numbers and express them not in the coupling constant G string, which is appropriate if it's, of course, at weak coupling, but in another variable Q, which is e to the power minus G string. And so Q is small if G string is very large. So this is a good parameter to use at strong coupling. Then it's actually quite kind of trivial mathematics to rewrite the whole thing in terms of an infinite product of these powers of Q. And in fact, it's something that mathematicians studied in the 19th century. It's a sum over what's called 3D partitions. And a 3D partition is just as you have partitions in two dimensions that you use in the representation theory of unitary groups. But now think of them as made out of little cubes. And so the structures that you can build here, you can say how many of these structures can I build with a fixed number of kind of Lego blocks. And that's giving you the coefficient of the particular power of Q. So for instance, if you look at the series, it starts with 1, 1, 3, 6. And that's just a way to build 0, 1. There are three ways to put two of these cubes. And there are six ways to put three, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very beautiful combinatorial structure. And it's the expansion in terms of these kind of data, which is the strong coupling expansion of that answer. And it's a beautiful work here, actually, that also has applications to real three-dimensional condensed matter, because these the great thing of Calabi-Yau manifolds is that if you take the kind of only take the real part, you're actually in the physical three dimensions, is that you can study these kind of statistical systems. So here, these pictures, you should either think of that somebody put really a whole box of Lego in the corner of your room, or you should think of this, you're looking edge-on in terms of this brick, but it's kind of eroding. And so that's what's called melting crystals. Beautiful and very integrated system of statistical mechanical models with various variations that you can study and then actually have phase transitions. And you can study in the various phases. And the great thing is that the phases of the condensed matter system are exactly the phases that we expect in quantum geometry. That is to say, there is a class. So this is just the sum of these kind of crystals. There is a so-called limit shape, which you get if you become the size of the boxes become very small, but the total ensemble becomes very large, where you get a new geometrical structure. And in fact, these are somehow the phase transitions. So we have, at weak coupling and small string scale, we have just empty the classical three-dimensional space. Then the stringy geometry is actually the limit where you get these kind of elegant surfaces that are the limit shapes. And the really quantum geometrical structure you get when you see the individual pixels of these crystals, and which is, again, encouraging. It's encouraging that our way of thinking of quantum structures kind of is being reproduced by statistical mechanical systems exactly in the metaphor of a kind of emergent geometry appearing here in the middle out of this kind of crystalline structure in the kind of thermodynamic limit. Now, the final example I want to mention is was around already for a long time, which is matrix models. And I think matrix models, again, is it's just the tip of an iceberg, the iceberg being finding algebraic structures, studying them in certain limits, and extracting classical geometry out of it. So geometry not as input, but as emergent structure out of more fundamental algebraic structures. And I would say there's nothing more simpler algebraic object than a matrix model, because what is it? It's just a path integral over an n by n matrix. And of course, the original Wigner matrix model had a very simple Gaussian distribution. And Wigner's great insight was that, you know, you can look at these, he of course thought of them as ensembles of random Hamiltonians. It's very difficult to diagonalize an n by n Hamiltonian, but you can study their statistics in an elegant way. In fact, what Wigner discovered is that the eigenvalues of an n by n matrix, they will spread out. But they will spread out of a range of size square root n. That is to say, if you start, so you might expect that the values of the eigenvalues would go range much further, but in some sense, they are kind of pulled together. And he noticed that if you appropriately rescale the size of the eigenvalues, we can make the domain of the eigenvalues to be finite. So there's the famous limit, which we now call the Hoeff limit, the limit where n to infinity, the string coupling of the coupling constant going to zero, keeping n g string or n times h bar fixed. It's like the Bohr-Sommerfeld limit of semi-classical mechanics. Then actually, what you get a finite density of eigenvalues. And in fact, Wigner computed the shape, the profile of the eigenvalue density, and found famously the semicircle. So found that this actually was a beautiful geometrical object. Not only that, but had a very sharp edge. So the eigenvalues kind of stopped here, and there's a kind of a critical point here where the eigenvalue density goes to zero instantaneous. Now, this is something you can understand. In fact, you can understand, again, from a classical, from a statistical mechanical point of view. This is the Dyson gas. So if you think of the eigenvalues about diagonalizing the matrix, the eigenvalues actually get some interesting dynamics. Not only are they moving in this quadratic potential, in the case of the Gaussian model, but there is also a force that repels them. Just from the Jacobi determinant, there is this lambda I minus lambda j term, which is a repulsive Coulomb force in two-dimensional Coulomb force is a logarithm. And so the eigenvalues are not only clustered together at the bottom of the potential, but there's some way in which they want to kind of get out of their ways. And they're kind of spaced in a more even way because of this repelling Coulomb force. That was Dyson's famous point of view on thinking of this in terms of statistical mechanical system. And so that's how the eigenvalue density is developed. And it's very easy to do this in a much more general setting. So you can take a potential that's not simply quadratic, but is an arbitrary polynomial. In fact, it's all very nice to do this over the complex numbers. And so then you will have so-called filling fractions. The eigenvalues will cluster together, not only, in fact, to be proper, you should include, in some sense, eigenvalues and anti-eigenvalues. So you should cluster them both at all the critical points of the potential, both the bottom of the potential and the top of the potential. And you get a much more interesting geometrical structure. And what you find, you not get a circle, but if you analyze this, you get actually what's called a hyperelliptic curve. That is to say, not that the equation y squared is x squared plus something, but y squared is basically a general polynomial. And that means that you get a kind of a complex curve or a Riemann surface out of the matrix model. I think it's, again, one of the cleanest cases where you take an algebraic structure and you get a geometrical structure as output. Because in the large n limit of studying these matrix models and in all their variations, there are many ways in which you can push this subject, you can actually build arbitrary Riemann surfaces out. So you could study in some sense. So the claim here is that there's a large class of manifolds that will appear in the thermodynamical limit, this is the Hoeff limit of these matrix models. And for instance, if you do it again for the simplest case, the case of the Gaussian model, the curve that you get out is actually a Wigner circle, but now seen as a complex curve. So we think of here the equation, as I wrote it here, y squared is x squared plus mu, as not describing a circle, but actually as this complex curve, so two-dimensional surface, which then, if you cut it here, you actually discover Wigner's circle as being part of that. Now, this is something that you can push much further. And let me say a few words about that, because there's another element here in which geometry and algebra are interchanged. And actually, matrix models are connected to this. And that's the connection of thinking of algebraic and geometrical structures in more complicated field theories. So let me illustrate this. Now, if you generally, what we noticed is that if you study, what we do in this way, in this program, is that we are relating geometrical structures to algebraic structures in a slightly different way, but I think they're intimately connected. In fact, it's a relation between, in the simplest form, there are many, many variations of this line of thinking. We associate gate theories, four-dimensional gate theories, with, in this case, two-dimensional algebraic structures. And the connection is as follows. It's the shape of the manifold, it's the shape of the four-manifold that gets translated into the algebraic structure we find in the conformal field theory. And vice versa, the algebraic structure in the four-manifold science, so for instance, the choice of gauge group of the gauge theory, gets translated to a geometrical structure in the conformal field theory. So if you think about, I mean, one way to think about these structures is what is a, for instance, what is a gauge theory? Well, the gauge theory is you take one of each. You take a gauge group, so you pick some algebraic element, SU2, and you pick a manifold, say R4. So what is a gauge theory? It's combining the algebra and the geometry and building it together and making a quantum field theory. And in a similar way, we see that the two-dimensional structure has the same form, but the roles of geometry and algebra are interchanged. So it's again pointing out these things really have to be seen in conjunction. And one way to understand this is that there are these six-dimensional theories, the 2.0 theory, or two-form theories in six dimensions, all very mysterious, and that in some sense, what you can take, there's a kind of a unified structure in six dimensions that I really would like to explain to mathematicians, but I think we have no idea to even begin to start that conversation. And if we take the six-dimensional theory and wrap it over the two dimensions of the Riemann surface, you get something in four dimensions where you now have the field theory in four dimensions will be characterized by your choice of the Riemann surface. And if you go in the other direction, you can, of course, go in the other direction, take the six-dimensional theory and dimensional reduce it by compactifying on the four-manifold. And now the four-dimensional structure, geometry, will actually encode the algebraic structure in two dimensions. So there's a kind of a nice symmetry between these two structures. And the most famous example is actually the way instanton calculations in four dimensions have that character. So, you know, in four dimensions, again, looking at topological theories, they will basically be involved not by general gauge field configurations, but by looking at self-dual connections, so solutions of the equation f equals star f. And in general, we know that if you have these four manifolds, you study the ensemble of instantons on the four manifolds with a given topological characteristics, then out of this you will make a moduli space of very high dimension in general, the moduli space of all the instanton configurations. And part of the mathematical interest in instantons was always that you can study the four manifold by studying the moduli space. I mean, the moduli space is a deep reflection of the underlying geometry of the four manifold itself. And so studying these spaces, you get interesting structures. You can localize, in good cases, the path integral to these instantons. And so what you're getting, again, is something very similar to what we saw in two-dimensional string theory, is you get a sum over all the instantons where the numbers dn are invariants of the moduli space. So by studying the moduli space of instantons, you can compute the numbers d of n, and you have a series expansion where q is written as e to 2 pi I tau, and as I showed on the previous slide, tau is the complexified gauge coupling. So it's the natural thing that you want to be large at weak coupling. So we noticed in various cases we can compute these things explicit. And the remarkable thing is that in many cases, these partition functions, as was first shown by Waffa and Witten in the 1990s, is that these partition functions have beautiful properties under transformation. In particular, they, in the good cases, they show that they are invariant under SL2Z transformation. So there are TS dualities acting on these partition functions. And in fact, in many cases, the partition function itself, sorry, the partition function is a, can be interpreted as a two-dimensional partition function. So a partition function of a conformal field theory. In fact, often they are chiral conformal field theories. So, and in fact, Nakajima in the study of the mathematics of these moduli spaces was the first to discover this. But the remarkable thing is that you take your four manifolds, you study the moduli space of instantons, and out of nowhere, a two-dimensional conformal field theory appears. So not only the character, so to say, but you can reconstruct the whole Hilbert space of the conformal field theory in terms of a quantization of the modelized spaces of instantons. So the language of two-dimensional conformal field theory is deeply tied into studying four dimensions. And the choice of the four manifolds actually will determine what the conformal field theory is. And for instance, this huge, beautiful class of examples where the four manifold is a quotient of R4 by a subgroup of SU2, the ADE manifolds. And in fact, in this case, you really get a very clean connection because the conformal field theories that pop out of the instanton calculus are characterized by the same Lie algebras. So it's really one-to-one. Just for a little bit technical, but there's a wonderful variation of this which is relevant for not n equals 4 supersymmetry, but n equals 2 supersymmetry, where actually you are not only studying the modelized spaces on instantons, the manifold in this case is R4 or S4, but you're also keeping track that there is a natural symmetry group acting on that R4, which is the rotations around the two planes. So there's a kind of an equivariant version of that that is good to compute. And that's actually very closely related to the cybergridden solutions. Why I want to mention this is that, again, you know, there's these two things can be tied together using matrix models. And I want to finish by explaining a few words about that. This connection between gauge theory and conformal field theory was brought with the work of Davide and his collaborators at a much, much higher level by actually making a very precise conjecture how the gauge theory and the conformal field theory related. It's the famous AGT conjecture that tells you that in the appropriate setting, the gauge theory calculation, so the four-dimensional calculation, is actually calculations in two dimensions of a set of operators, vertex operators, in a rather famous conformal field theory, namely the Liouville field theory, which is this free scalar field with an exponential interaction. Now, why is this also natural from this kind of bigger picture connecting non-abelian structures and emergent geometry? Well, that goes down to the following point, that if you think about how would you typically build in gauge theories in four dimensions from a string theory perspective, is that you actually look at singularities in the internal space. So you look at Calabi-Yau manifolds, which are singular. For instance, if you have a singularity of this type here, so uv plus y to the n equals 0, that's a famous case of one of these manifolds with a so-called a n minus 1 singularity. We expect, if you have such a singularity, that is actually the gauge group in four dimensions will be the group SUN. Now, in fact, there's a very beautiful way to understand this from matrix models. I said, in general, if you have matrix models, you get certain Riemann surfaces out. And if you take a simple Gaussian model, you like this one, trace phi squared, you can put a coefficient here. The curve that you get is actually the following curve. It's the circle, but it's the circle kind of, it's more like an ellipse. It's kind of pulled in one kind of direction. One axis is much longer than the other axis. So if you take a kind of an extreme case of a matrix model, but you look at the matrix model without a potential, which is kind of very singular, it's basically thinking of this gas of eigenvalues, where there's no potential constraining them, so they kind of float everywhere. And so you have to be very careful how you take the exact limit. You get actually, in some sense, in a case where also the eigenvalue distribution becomes totally flat. And the curve becomes a singular curve. The curve becomes the curve y squared equal to 0. So in some sense, singular curves are appearing very naturally from matrix models. In fact, in an even more natural way, because it's the matrix model without any potential. And indeed, by just following this line of thinking, you can see that the moment you start to introduce a potential, it's really like introducing a Liouville term. So you can think of the gas of eigenvalues as basically just expanding the Liouville term in the conformal field theory. And you can read this equation in two ways. You can basically say Liouville theory is equivalent to studying matrix models and studying the eigenvalues, where the insertions of the Liouville operator is just creating for you the individual eigenvalues. So the gas of eigenvalues, or the matrix, and the Liouville system are very closely related. And in fact, if you go to the case, which is kind of interesting, this extra equivariant deformation, it turns out that for the matrix model, you have to do something interesting too. You have to look at the natural force between the eigenvalues, which was this van der Monde determinant. But it actually gets, you get a different coefficient here. That is to say, you still have this logarithmic potential pulling the eigenvalues apart, but the strength of this logarithmic force can actually be tuned up and down. And so following this, you get actually, you can write the AGT conjecture and these kind of two-dimensional structures in a matrix model. It's a matrix model with kind of determinants inserted, and that's a model that has been studied before. It's essentially comes down to a matrix model with a logarithmic potential. Studying these curves, then, these quantum curves, you can resolve the eigenvalue, the singularities again of these curves. And the endpoint is basically by studying the system, geometry appears. And it's exactly kind of the geometry that we are kind of expecting. So it's again a beautiful example to show that algebraic structures are, in some sense, very naturally tying these geometries together. And in fact, are also of relevance for four-dimensional, to understand four-dimensional field theory. Well, at this point, you've probably reached the highest level of confusion, which I think is appropriate, because I think, actually, if you look at this whole picture, I would say there are kind of two ways in which I feel about it. In fact, extremely fruitful, we are discovering new connections. And here I just put some of the items that passed in this colloquium. So there's various kind of mathematical structures that are relevant to it. Non-commutative geometry, Riemann surfaces, gate theory, string theory, matrix models, it's all there. Topology, geometry, and I could put other things. I mean, there's a close relation to certain number theoretical issues. More and more fields of mathematics are touched by this movement. And another thing is actually if you just look at how this field, which I think you could say it was started in the early 1970s, when people start to realize that gate theory description of the standard model was actually closely connected to studying vector bundles and connections, what the mathematicians had been doing, and with things like the index theorem, et cetera. And after, so in this more than 40 years, I would say we have seen a very steady return on investment. I think every year there are even more unsuspected surprises of other areas of mathematics coming in. But as I said, you know, one thing I find extremely frustrating is that there isn't really a coherent structure behind this. It looks like we are just doing kind of little samples of a lot of a structure. Forget about our physical theories, even the mathematics here. What is the right mathematical way? Is there some kind of global definition? Can we move away from this patch by patch and building kind of dictionaries? I mean, one of the great things, of course, in this kind of landscape of theories and ideas is that, you know, you most fruitful is actually go on the border of two of these domains and take your, build a dictionary and take subject A and study the fundamental concepts and translate them into the language of subject B and hope that some questions in language A are difficult in A and easy to answer in B and vice versa. And we have seen some examples. And we have seen consistency. That is to say, if you then translate from A to B to C and back to A, that all kind of works. But I actually personally feel that we are kind of really missing some crucial mathematical ingredients that bring these domains together. In some sense, we are kind of unifying things that were kind of pulled apart in a way through history, through the way we are connecting to various physical theories. But I would say that we are lacking, in some sense, the powerful mathematics that would make all of this kind of obvious. Now, as I said, there is a parallel to some big programs in mathematics like the Langlands program. And I must say, there often also people are kind of failing to have a common core understanding and working often also case by case. So I think there's no guarantee that such universal structure exists, let alone that we will find it in a finite time. But I think what is true, that if you just look at the landscape, and I'm really, really only kind of sketched a few elements that I've been personally involved with, it's extremely exciting that we are tying things together. And I think actually it's also rewarding in the sense, I'm sure we all have a very deep feeling that, you know, whether it's theoretical physics or mathematics, it's a unified subject. You know, in some sense, it doesn't really matter on which subject you work, or where, which problem, they're all kind of tied together in a very deep way. It would be wonderful if we at some point can find the mathematical language that comes along with that feeling. So thank you very much.
Questions? I guess first the students, if I understand correctly.
So why is this all unreasonable? I mean, we're asking new questions. It seems like we need new tools. I think it would make sense that we would need new mathematics. So I don't understand why it's unreasonable to have this. I don't know.
Commented on. Can be used again, again, again. So even in contexts that you wouldn't suspect. So things, yeah. So there are various answers, you know, to this. So one is think that, you know, there's nothing to be surprised of. You know, I think, you know, one thing which I find here, what I find here unreasonable is that. What's interesting is that, in some sense, let me put it like this. Mathematics is typically, the classical fields in mathematics develop because we are basically operating, I would say, at room temperature. Now, it's macroscopic structures around us that led us to geometry, to calculus, et cetera, et cetera. There's no guarantee a priori that if you move to areas like quantum physics, that the same mathematical language is still useful. And actually, what we have seen now, I think, is that more and more that I would say it's almost the other way around. Putting mathematical problems in the context, the quantum context, is even more powerful than putting them in the classical context. So the physical intuition that we have achieved, sometimes at great cost, of understanding quantum mechanics with many counterintuitive things, summing over histories, et cetera. That was all, you know, as Planck himself said, was an act of desperation to build quantum mechanics. So you might think actually that kind of means that, okay, so nature is pushing you in this direction. This is not the way mathematics wants to go. You know, that's just not the way she likes very much. And then you notice that time and time again that the quantum mechanical version of it is so much richer, has so much more structure, and that what we think of kind of almost classical mechanics and classical mathematics is it, like, what is a geometrical space? What is a group? What is a Lie algebra, et cetera? That they're very naturally seen as limit cases of something deeper that comes out of the quantum world. And coming back to my final point, I think that the core intuitions we have in mathematics are still our classical intuitions. So I guess all of this is kind of pointing vaguely to, is there something, you know, suppose we would have developed mathematics as elementary particles, being, you know, in a quantum world ourselves, how would mathematics have developed? But I would say there's almost no mathematical structure that I know of that doesn't have a kind of quantum deformation. You know, you can put somehow h-bar in it and not only get something which is interesting, but often deeper and connected in a more fundamental way to other areas than the classical. He said, wait a moment, theoretical physicists are developing all this crazy field theory and gate theories, etc. We should follow this because this will be the source of great mathematics. And in fact, the opposite of theoretical physicists vis-a-vis mathematics was exactly the same. There's this famous letter, I think, from, I'm not sure which mathematician invited Feynman to a conference in 1965 or something to discuss about the new mathematics. And he sends a typical one-line rude answer, something, totally not interested in this or something. You know, it's a categorical, this is just moving in the wrong direction. And so I think it is unreasonable how many also, and I didn't have time here to explain, but there's a whole series of great outstanding mathematics problems that have been solved using this intuition. So I would say this is a sizable fraction of what happened in the last 30 years in pure math can be traced down to its quantum origins. And I think that's
Hi, Rob. It's a comment and a question. The comment, you'll forgive me. I think in your picture of bubbles, multiply connected with multiple influences, some of the discoveries of loop quantum gravity deserve to be there on the diagram as well. The relationship between general relativity and self-dual structures and topological field theories. Good. So now I have a question. Way back in the 80s, when the
Okay, I think that's a full point. In some sense, so the question was about the categorization, which is, it's really, I think, it's really a mathematician would think in terms of, right? So go from a number to see the number as a dimension of a vector space, see the vector space as basically an index of a category and moving up and up and up. So I think that's a good example of a direction that mathematicians have taken much further than any physicists would think they would. And for instance, in knot theory, I think, where we saw the first, the Khovanov invariance of knots, I think physicists patted themselves on the back that, wait a moment, you have this knot theory invariance which looked like two-dimensional, and then we have the three-dimensional structure using Chern-Simon theory. But when actually that itself looked like it was a Hilbert space associated to a 3+1 dimensional structure. And now there are various physics intuitions that try to explain this, in fact, going to 5 and 6 dimensions even. I would say that's a good example where math kind of beat physics in terms of finding the language and the results. And so I think, there's a general point here where we have, I think, now quite a few examples on a picture of. I would still say there's still many cases where we have, for instance, these invariants, where integers appear, where we didn't expect them to be integers. And where
very beautiful. Just to comment, I mean, your whole presentation is very beautiful, but somehow holography is lurking, and holography in the going up in dimension is related to categorification as our top level.
I'm actually, it's two ways in which an extra dimension appears. I'm actually a toy model of holography in terms of, because the matrix model is quantum mechanics, not even, it's zero dimensional, right? It's just one matrix. It's a zero dimensional field theory. And a complex dimension pops out, which is the dimension on which the eigenvalues are building up. So it's a toy model of holography. I think actually it's a fascinating point, but I always thought myself as categorification, which was like some hidden extra time dimension or something, as kind of separate from holography, but perhaps the two are connected. I wouldn't know.
Uh,
type and